This is part two of a two-part episode.
We brought on an alleged expert on Eldritch Moon development. None other than, why, the lead developer of Magic Origins and Eldritch Moon, Sam Stoddard!
Oh, hey!
Mandarin. So you mentioned before color pie violations, and as you know, we've had Ethan. Is he down to eight fingers? Eight fingers, Fleischer on. Does Mark's penalty for color pie violations extend to the development team? Like, does he have the ability to summon anyone in R&D who's designed a color pie violation that made it to print into his office? To put his hand in the his or her hand in the clamp.
Fortunately, he doesn't have an office. He just has he's in the pit, which is our kind of open cube area. So
yeah,
the screams.
Well, I assumed it was a public display.
Oh yeah, that would be true. I was going to say that the screams might be disruptive to the other people. No, Mark, I'm very glad that he is there to keep everyone honest about the color pie. It certainly can be frustrating at times, and it's something where we have dialogues about it. It's not a set thing. I mean, over time, as we expand or remove certain things from colors, we know that we have to add things. Sometimes we go too far. I mean, I think that white in recent years has probably gone a little too far in terms of being able to remove anything. Red, I think, we've taken away too much of the kind of burn power of red as we're trying out new things. And so,
yeah.
But he's big on a lot of things and making sure that we are maintaining their integrity, because it is really one of those kind of inches things where my favorite example is always the 2G instant that makes a 1/1 death touch wasp that fights tough creature and opponent controls. Yeah. And it's like, it's not dark banishing. It's really close to dark banishing. And so you can couch almost any card in flavor if you want to. Like, I could say, well, so we have this card that makes it's you know, 3GG, and it makes 5 Hornets, and they fight with Death Touch, and they fight everything. And it's like, okay, that's just Wrath of God. It's like, no, it's Hornets. It's Hornets sting everything. And it's like, no. That's not okay. Like, we can't clearly. Yeah, you can make an excuse for why Hornets swarming and killing everything is flavorfully works, but it's more than just flavor. Like, it actually has to feel like the color, and Mark is a great way of kind of passing the smell test and making sure that all the things we've told ourselves in development or made rationale for why this card has slowly drifted away from doing something that feels like it's right for its color just doesn't work, and we have to find a different solution.
Mm-hmm.
I love the color pie. I think it's one of the defining things that's made Magic be a success for so long. I think without it, we might not have a game anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that. It's the constant ebb and flow and the requirement to lean on other colors in order to get what you need out of a particular, let's say, a nearly mono green deck. If it needs an efficient card draw, you can add blue. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And have to add blue, so. And that does keep it fresh, because then you can take that away and you can add it, and you can then play with the efficiency of each of those different aspects that embody the color pie and then make a brand new deck, even with the same colors.
I think it applies doubly to Commander as well, because we're restricted. We can't just splash a color outside of our Commander's identity.
Right.
And it adds to the flavor of our format a lot.
Yeah, it does. We have a couple more questions about balance and the process in general, and then we'll try to dive into Eldritch Moon, but it's just talking about balance and talking about the development process is so fascinating. We have a lot of exposure to the design process, right? That front end part of the process because of Mark's podcast, and we've had Ethan on a couple of times, and he talks about that extensively. But this finer aspect of, like, the fine tuning of the cards and all of that, that's very very interesting. It's something that I think most people don't consider because, of course, you know, you see it when they release, when you guys release cards, and especially during preview season, people are like, this card sucks. And then they play it and it's like, oh, actually, I'll just shut up. I never said that.
Yeah.
So then you look at a card I was going through this morning and I found Dusk Feaster. I hadn't seen this one before, and it's 5 and black for a 4/5 vampire with flying and delirium. And if it has delirium, Dusk Feaster costs 2 generic mana less to cast. Right. So why did you create that card instead of a straight 3 and black flying vampire?
So a lot of making limited work and making each set feel different, and this set's limited feel different than the last year's limited, is getting people to do different things and rewarding them in different ways. So you're generally not going to see an uncommon that's just like 3 BB for a 4/5 flyer. You might see it every once in a while, but it's certainly going to be one of the stronger uncommons in a set when we do print that. By doing something like this, where it's much weaker unless you have delirium, we're both incentivizing people to actually play delirium decks, especially in limited, but we're also making it so that when you're drafting, if you know you have a deck that's easily capable of having delirium, then you have this card that's just super powerful in your deck that's not going to be super powerful in somebody else's deck. So it's both more likely to float to you in a draft, but it also just makes your deck feel very different than somebody else's.
So somebody who's pulling delirium is going to pull Dusk Feaster as well, probably.
Right, but if you're playing a non-delirium black deck, like you're playing, if you're playing the zombies deck and you don't really have the card types to delirium, you might not take this. You'll take something that's going to fit better in your deck and make your deck stronger.
Yeah. What about balancing the difference between, say, instants and sorceries? Like you look at Succumb to Temptation for 1 and black versus Sign and Blood, which is just black.
Yeah, this is often very much just feel the card and what they do. Removal and card draw are the two things that you see kind of usually charge the most for instants, and it's one of the things that we kind of tweak the most later on. Usually, something like this, instant is quite a bit stronger, especially if you're playing in a constructed deck and a control deck. The ability to say go, have your opponent worry if you have counterspell mana up, not do anything, and at the end of your turn just draw cards, is a huge part of what makes control decks strong.
Hmm.
Also, just by making both of these cards, so by having the BB sorcery version or the 1 BB instant version, we get to kind of choose which ones we put in sets, and based off of the curve of the other cards and what we want to be strong. We can't make every card in limited equally strong, and we don't want that. So it might be that, you know, in this set, we give you Sign and Blood because that's what we want to be strong here, or Read the Bones or something like that. And in this other set, we give you Succumb to Temptation, where we want something else to be strong. And so we give you something that's a little weaker, but more flexible.
Right.
I, for one, prefer Succumb. I'm going to be pulling Sign out of all my decks and putting Succumb in instead.
Yeah, one of our deck testers kind of poo-pooed it. I won't say his name just in case it turns out to be embarrassing. But I looked at that and I'm like, no, actually Succumb is better than Sign and Blood because of that ability to draw at the end of your opponent's turn.
Yep.
But again, I prefer instants. Yep. So.
Efficiency, or flexibility rather, is something that it is hard for a lot of people to realize just how much that's worth. Because usually you might say, well, it's not really worth a whole mana. And it's like, well, not always. Sometimes when it is, it really is. So you kind of have to charge as though that's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's the difference between a card like Stroke of Genius and Mindspring. One's a sorcery, one's instant. They essentially do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One's a 10-cent card on the secondary market. It was still, after numerous reprintings, like $3 or $4.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of correlated to that, does the development team have a lot of influence over which cards get reprinted? Do they look at cards and say, well, actually, this is a card that fits a theme better or works a little bit better than this one that's been handed over to us?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, the development team has the final say on what gets printed in any standard legal set. The design team usually says, here are our favorite cards, and the development team tries to, as much as possible, honor those. I mean, if they handed over a set and said, you know what, our favorite card is Tarmogoyf or something, and we just don't think the set's going to work without it, might be like, we're going to have to disagree on that one. But, you know, we want to make sure that the set they're handing over, they feel like development is making the set that they were interested in making. Development usually is the one who gets kind of is much more concerned about the reprints, because we're the ones who are saying, okay, where's this going to fit into standard? And perhaps most importantly for this often is just like, well, people might be tired of playing with or against a certain card. It might feel right in your set, but people have kind of, you know, we don't want to have in the way that you would never want Siege Rhino to be in standard for ever. You know, it might be like, oh, in this set, they hand over something, and we say, yeah, that's been in standard for a while, or it's been in standard recently. We kind of want to try something different out, give it a slight tweak or twist or something, and try something a little bit different out so people just feel like they're playing against different things.
Mm-hmm. So, like, Giant Spider might change to a 1/5
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, it might be something. It could be something as simple as that, or it might be that, well, sometimes Giant Spider is really strong because of very specific reasons. It might be like, well, the flyers in this set, there's a lot of 2-power or 3-power, 2-toughness flyers. Giant Spider just shuts them all down. And it might be that if the flyers decks are really suffering, we might want to put in 2G, 1/5, or 1/4 reach so that it doesn't block those decks quite as much. It might be that those decks are too strong and we want to put in something that's, you know, even stronger against those decks. It's, you know, we just kind of move things around in that way.
Mm. All right. Nate, do you want to ask this question from Nick?
Friend of the show, Nick Gerald Grulski says, silver bordered cards were originally a space used to explore mechanics not traditionally used on black bordered cards, but we see some of those designs bleed over, most recently with the new meld mechanic. What goes on when deciding to bring these unmechanics to legal play?
Magic is getting old. We are 23 years old, and it is harder and harder to, you know, shock people with brand new and crazy things because we've just done so much. When Unglued first came out, there's a lot of things that were like, boy, they would never do this. And then we eventually were like, eh, yeah, we can do that. Like, that's actually not crazy. One of my favorite uncards that I wish we could just put into a set, or wish had been put into a set, I guess, is Blast from the Past, which just could have been in, like, Future Sight. It just could be a real card. And when that was printed, it was like, that's crazy. It has, like, 5 keywords, and these are old things. We would never do that. And then did a whole block about that. So it would have worked. It would have been fine. But this was a mechanic that was actually first used in Duel Masters, Meld was, which is a Japanese game, or it's started off as an American-Japanese game, and it has remained in production in Japan for a long time, and it's something that we still produce in our offices, and Ken Nagel, who is the lead designer of this set, had worked on, and he was a huge fan of it, and the games are different enough that it's hard to exactly compare what these things do. And they're up to, they have like, Duel Masters does a lot more crazy things than Magic does, both because it's aimed at a slightly younger audience and because they have some other technology that we don't have. They have a kind of what's called the Phantom Zone, where cards that don't get shuffled into your deck. And so there's like a card that smells like curry. There's triple faced cards, like actual triple faced cards. They have these things that just turn into these giant, like, origami type things. We can't really do that for various reasons, but, you know, this idea of I put these two cards together and they make this one giant card is a very visceral and cool feeling, and Ken Nagel had been trying to get this into a set for a while. He tried putting in new Phyrexia to kind of show off the Phyrexian invasion stuff. That didn't really work out, and one of the concept artists working on the Shadows concept push had this picture of Bruna and Gisela melded into this giant angel. All of a sudden, it was just like, oh, that's really cool. We could use this mechanic that we talked about before, and, you know, it was kind of the thing where this felt right. It's a mechanic that you can do with double face cards. You just can't do it with single face cards very easily. And, you know, we don't put double face cards in every set. And this was a place where it made sense. It was something that if we skipped it here, it would certainly take a long time before we came back to it. So we decided to go for it.
It's very cool.
You seized the opportunity.
We did. I do not believe we will be buying opponents' drinks any or players' drinks in any kind of soon things or ripping cards up. But I do think that as we kind of make new things, every once in a while, there'll be something in an unset where it's like, you know, that actually was kind of cool, and we could just do that now. And we'll hit those eventually.
I'm imagining now that Kaladesh is a really crude plane, and everything's like City of Ass. And...
oh, if only. If only.
Kind of just toilet humor across the whole place.
Yeah.
I definitely want food scented cards.
I mean,
so can we get that?
The print technology exists apparently. I don't know how they did it, but
yeah,
I can tell you that it must exist if it happened in Duel Masters. So I'm sure we'll add it to the list.
That'd be a pretty cool booster pack. You could sniff your boosters to see if you were like ripping the right pack you needed. Nope.
Oh, can you? And they could reprint Sewer Nemesis.
Oh.
No way, man. That'd be great. Oh. How much fun would that be? You're in a draft, you rip Sewer Nemesis, and all of a sudden it's like, ooh, who did that? And you're like, it's just my pack, guys. Just my pack.
I want to know, listeners, tweet us what the best and worst smelling magic cards would be.
Yes. Yes. Both all-time and Eldritch Moon. Let's talk a little bit about Eldritch Moon. I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention Ulrich of the Krallen Horde and talk a little bit about him. Everybody was looking for a legendary werewolf to put them as a commander on their werewolf decks in the hopes that you could build a viable werewolf deck instead of a bunch of filler. And now Eldritch Moon has certainly introduced a bunch of really cool werewolves that are, of course, blended with Eldrazi. Why isn't Ulrich more tribal? I think that's the biggest complaint, that he works with anybody and he doesn't actually care except when he's targeting the non-werewolf creature and opponent controls.
I mean, I think in hindsight, if I could go back and change it, I would make him more tribal. What we were trying to do with him was make him into something that could be both a card for commander and also have some chances of seeing some standard play. And, you know, he's pretty strong, so it is certainly possible. But
yeah,
just hearing the kind of outcry from the commander community where this is something where, yeah, if I could go back, I would probably give it something that was more tribal. I know that the original version that Ken handed off, I believe when he transformed, you returned all werewolves from your graveyard to your hand, which
that would have been cool.
Yeah,
whoa.
May or may not have been the right thing, but certainly would have done, I think, what the commander community has been asking for this card, and probably really what we should have focused on some of its strengths somewhere, as opposed to right now, where it really is just kind of, you're right, acting as a card on its own.
I think people were expecting or would have liked a card that somehow gave you more control, like a conditional control over the flipping of your werewolves. Because the nature of Commander is, because it's multiplayer, it's much harder to keep your werewolves in a form that you want, flip the size you want. And people just felt they needed that, I think. And that's why a lot of people have said they're still going to use Rurik Thar as their commander, because he discourages your opponents from playing lots of spells.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So Charles Moreau, in our deck testing group, he kind of volunteered, or as soon as this was spoiled, he volunteered to make a deck with Ulrich at the head. And the fight mechanic is really useful. It turns out he's, you know, a pretty good utility commander in that sense. So there's hope for him as an overall commander, but I think what will end up happening is he becomes a member of the 99 as opposed to the commander, and then Rurik Thar remains the werewolf commander of choice. But I would like to pull him. There you go. We're all doing pre-releases. And now, are you guys allowed to do public pre-releases?
No. So what usually ends up happening is if, you know, people can go to pre-releases and kind of spell sling. We do have an internal pre-release that'll happen, I think, on Thursday. But we can't play in limited events until basically game day, I think. It's something like that.
You're sitting at the pre-release night, you open a booster and you're like, I did not design this card to do this. Someone's changed it.
Oh no.
We're going to play it the way I intended.
That delay is to give everybody a chance to kind of catch up in terms of knowledge, right?
Yeah, and actually, until very recently, yeah. we just couldn't play in any events. And
yeah.
luckily, it was actually Tom Lapilli who, he was still working here. We have this all-hands meeting, and the CEO takes open questions, and he was like, why can't we play in Magic tournaments? And everyone was kind of surprised at how many people were like, yes, no, we should totally do that. And I think for some reason, they had just was unexpected how many people really wanted to do that. And so they've changed our policies. We certainly have limits for what we can play in. We can't clearly play in the Pro Tour or anything like that. But basically, we can play in Eternal formats pretty much all the time, but Standard and Draft, there's a few weeks basically where we are not allowed to play with them until the cards have been out enough to the idea of giving everyone the same level of knowledge. It's funny because I often think that it might be we on average may have a detriment after the first week because people only know what cards do, not what they used to do. And I have many times forgotten a card is not an instant anymore, and it's really awkward to we changed that, didn't we? That's that burn spells a sorcery. Shoot. Awkward. I swear it used to be. That doesn't work. You can't do that.
Yeah. We actually get hopeful on this end of it. We get hopeful that something's an instant, and we'll very often try to play a sorcery as an instant. And get corrected. So there's a legendary spider now. How cool is that?
Sure is.
How did Ishkana come about?
It actually started off as Spider Ball. It was a 4GG star that entered the battlefield and cast spider spawning, which was pretty cute. And so it kind of got into the set. And as we were playing with it more and we were looking for more ways to really make Delirium work better in Constructed, all of a sudden this became a card that, looked like something that'd be pretty fun to figure out how to make it into an actual Constructed card. And so that's where it became this, at the time I think it was a 3GG 3/5 reach that made four spiders, and four spiders was a lot, and then when you cast your second one of these, it's really ridiculous. And this is another example of where, we can make a legendary. And then I was like, well, everyone wants a legendary creature. And so for a long time, it was just a mono green card. And we do this process where we put all the mythic rares up on a wall, and people can leave little comments for them if they have thoughts. And the overarching thing was, this needs to have a better color identity for Commander. It's interesting because you would think that most of the spiders in the Magic are green and black, but actually there's several red ones, but we didn't really have a way to figure out how to put it both a green and a black ability, so I eventually relented and put on a black ability, and we went with 6B because that's how much spider spawning cost. So it felt like a fun callback and something that was not usually going to be a huge power swing in the card, but if you are building a deck around this and you have a ton of spiders in play through this and Arachnogenesis and through your own spider spawnings, you can pretty quickly just eliminate people from the game.
Deck tester Johnny Crass asks, do you think the legendary Golgari Spider Queen Ishkana will have the same devoted religious following as the great Gitrog Frog God?
If people know what's good for them, they will definitely worship Ishkana, because she is pretty scary.
Yeah, but the Gitrog monster.
That's true.
Golgari did really well out of these two.
Yeah, this it block, did. Didn't it?
Yeah, something about Innistrad, especially with Delirium, green-black got a lot of stuff, because those were the kind of core Delirium colors and really where it felt the most... it was hitting a lot of the notes that we like to hit.
Yeah, the green-black dominance will continue through Kaladesh because, as we all know, artifacts like... never mind.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to Kaladesh block.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Anyway, carry on with this. Eldritch Moon's here and now.
So you chose 6B for that ability on Ishkana, but is that a little expensive, or did you... I mean, because you're tuning it for standard, so I guess for standard, it's a real bomb when that goes off.
Yeah, it's a little expensive. It was not intended. That ability was really put in there to make sure that it had the color identity for Commander. It's certainly something that can come up in standard, but it was not meant to be a huge part of the card's power. I think if we had charged less and made that a big part of the card power, it would just be less fun, because then your goal is to play Ishkanah, stall the board out, and then just, you know, drain your opponent out over a couple turns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll work beautifully.
That's the hope.
This next card. Let's talk a little bit about Emrakul, the Promised End. Yeah, that's a sweet card.
I finally get the Titan for my commander deck. It's here.
A 13-13 for 13. That's beautiful. Did you guys work to make that happen? How hard was that to make happen?
The original idea for the card was definitely a 13-mana 13-13. That all felt correct. The hard part was getting it to was figuring out the cost reduction part, because it turns out, unlike BFZ or Rise of the Eldrazi that are built around casting 13-mana spells, you could not cast a 13-mana spell in Shadows Limited. So we had to figure out a way to make it a little bit less. You know, it's usually something around 8 right. or, you know, 7, 8, 9, which is manageable. So we wanted that to be in same for standard. We wanted to be something that was manageable in these things. So, but yeah, the 13-mana 13-13 was kind of the starting point of, I know Mark Rosewater has talked a lot about the fact that he's gotten a lot of complaints of the fact that it's not 15-15. And I wonder what the alternate version is, where if we made it like, you know, I got a 15-mana 15-15, if people are like, but seriously, it should have been a 13-mana 13-13. That just makes sense. I have no idea which alternate version of the universe people are more happy with the, you know, aesthetics of the card, but I'm certainly much happier with the power of the card and the whole package where it is now.
Well, coming through the seabed like that really knocked a lot of the rough edges off of her. So she did lose some weight.
She's on a new plane. Maybe things are scaled differently. Who knows?
Yeah.
Now it only takes 13 squirrels to kill her. Flying squirrels, of course. when this card got spoiled, we, you know, obviously a big showpiece card like this is going to get talked about. And on our deck testing and Patreon groups, we had some people who were like, oh, I'm disappointed. I don't think it's powerful enough. It's like, really? What did you want Emrakul to do? To just basically say, 5 mana, you win the game? Because that's... What did you want? And no one could answer that. And I was like, right, my mission now is to cast this for 1 mana. I'm going to try and cast this for 1 mana using various things in a commander deck.
Yeah, this was a hard one, because the original Emrakul was created to be the most ludicrous creature ever printed. Like, yeah. It was like... What if we made the strongest creature ever, and I guess you could say Gristlebrand has competition with her, both designed by Brian Tidsman, I'll point out.
Both banned in Commander?
Both banned in Commander. Yeah, I usually find when something is banned in formats that we probably haven't hit the right spot with it. But it's like, oh, people are like, well, you know, people want Emrakul to be somehow bigger, and it's like, how are you supposed to go bigger than Emrakul? Like, Emrakul basically says you win the game unless your opponent has, like, Pestermite or something, or some weird thing. Do you want to take away that part? You know, the goal here was to make a version of Emrakul that felt epic and did cool things, but wasn't something that we would have to get banned in all the formats where, theoretically, Emrakul was kind of created for.
I'm just so happy, because I run a Kozilek Great Distortion deck, and I'm so happy I can have the third Titan in there.
It's very nice.
The old smile on my face.
Yeah, unlike Ishkanah is going to be recurred and bounced in and out of the graveyard, probably not in a pure Golgari deck.
Mm.
This one has to be cast, right? So in a way, actually, if you're running Temur, Sabretooth, and the other card that bounces, what is it, the Roaring Primadox, then you can just recur this thing.
Right. There's been a lot of talk about how, you know, people think that the only reason Mindslaver is good is because your opponent skips their whole turn. I think they missed the point of Mindslaver. It's better because your opponent doesn't get another turn afterwards. Like, Emrakul would be stronger if your opponent did not get a second turn. However, what we really wanted was something where you got to play your opponent's turn, utterly decimate them, and then there was some shot that could come back. Like, if you play it and your opponent just scoops every time, I mean, that's not the fun part. That's not really... It's, again, winning is fun, but if you actually get to take... It's more fun to take your opponent's turn, see all the cool things you can do to kill them with it, and then, you know, give them that opportunity to actually try to come back in the game rather than just, you know, outright winning the game.
Right.
See, I saw it in a slightly different way. I saw it as you take their turn, you destroy their board state, do all the nasty things you can do, and then let them take their extra turn so they can stand in the wreckage of what their life once was.
Top down that, exactly.
You demure player.
Yeah.
It matches the flavor almost one for one, right? It's a direct map to that flavor of Nahiri bringing Emrakul into the plane, and then everybody sort of, after the initial devastation, everybody has to react to it with what they have remaining.
Yeah.
Was that intentional?
Yeah, that was intentional. I mean, this is these major story points and legends, we do spend a bit of time really trying to make sure that they work, and, you know, obviously some end up working better than others, but we definitely try to do that thing where we try to help make the, as much as possible, make the kind of story play out in games in a fun and satisfying way.
Yeah. And then was the lead-in with horrors, and Nate might have more to say about this, but was the lead-in with horrors in Shadows over Innistrad intentionally deceptive to make us think that it was a Phyrexian Emrakul who was coming?
No. So, it's interesting because people, I've seen a lot of people say things about, like, well, you know, if you're going back to Shadows, why'd you have to, or Innistrad, why'd you have to bring Emrakul? And it's actually kind of the opposite of, we did these offsites every few years where we basically have people pitch ideas for cool things to do in the future. And Adam Lee, who at the time was working in our on Magic Stories, now working on D&D Story, but he had this pitch for kind of a cosmic horror version of Innistrad, where Emrakul would show up, and that would be the, you know, that he had some, you know, a pan of these cultists chanting, and then you find out that they're actually summoning Emrakul, and everyone loved it, and it's a, you know, it's a great fit. It's a great way to go back to Innistrad, and so the entire reason we kind of planned to go back to Innistrad, and to some extent Zendikar, was related to this idea of Emrakul on Innistrad. So it wasn't like, it wasn't like we were like, oh, well, how do we, you know, we're going to make the Innistrad. We want to, oh, how we have this extra Titan running around. I guess we'd shove it there. I mean, this was the reason for going back, and how Innistrad is a world that is difficult because it's all about tropes, and it worked perfectly the first time, well, for the most part. Avacyn Restored, which removed a lot of the tropes, I think, hit much less well. Partially because you didn't have all the, you know, cool Invisible Man and the, you know, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde and stuff. But we'd mined those tropes, well, not entirely, we'd mined a lot of them out. And so going back is difficult. It's like, well, what do we do the second time? Like, we can't exactly just have a different Jekyll and Hyde and a different Invisible Man. But by taking another, you know, this cosmic horror idea and taking that idea and being able to overlay it, all of a sudden we have a ton of new tropes we get to hit, and we get to go with more of the kind of body horror as opposed to just the psychological horror, and find the new space there. And so that really worked out well, and that is the reason we went there. I mean, we could also, I suppose, have done that with the Phyrexians, but I think the Phyrexians are a little, do things in a little different way, and it's not the kind of mysterious thing that the cosmic horror and Emrakul provided, and it would be, I think, a much more straightforward, you know, body snatcher story.
Yeah.
Praise be to Phyrexia. So a lot of people have likened this to H.P. Lovecraft type stuff, but I actually think it's more like David Cronenberg kind of influenced body horror, The Thing type stuff as well. John Carpenter's The Thing, not that weird 50s movie. I've loved it. Loved it, loved it. Right.
The emerge mechanic is really the idea of the kind of chest burster, like alien invasion type thing. It came out of this idea of, okay, the elevator pitch for Innistrad, Emrakul in Innistrad is awesome. It's, oh, this makes sense. She transforms bodies. This is the place about transformation. And then you get to actually making the set, and you're like, how do we show this? And it's like, what if we did double face cards? And it's like, we already do double face cards. Oh, right. Well, how do we show transformation otherwise? And it's like, well, we could do stuff that's like crappy versions of double face cards. Okay, no, that doesn't sound like a great idea. Well, we could do two per pack, and we had actually experimented with two per pack during the Shadows period, and it's like, yeah, that's really miserable. There are just so many double face cards everywhere. And so this came out of, well, what else can we do? And while the mechanic went through a lot of iterations, the idea of, well, the thing we can do is show a thing just kind of bursting open and turning into another thing is something you can't do in a double face card. And it was a really good spot for Emerge to show a different type of transformation that can be happening on Innistrad that's not exactly like kind of what we did before. It's not just double face cards. You know, certainly there's a cool thing about these double face cards going from a horror or something into an Eldrazi that shows you something, but it is that, you know, at some point it's not doing anything super new, and Emerge does something much different than the kind of transformation we're used to seeing on Innistrad.
Did it replace a mechanic?
The handoff mechanics from design, because design had really struggled with a lot of this.
Yeah.
The way that we do small sets, they tend to not have a ton of time in design. And this was one where I think they struggled because of the thing of, oh, this is going to be easy. We have everything planned out. And then you got to actually making cards up, and it's like, oh boy, this is way harder than we thought it was. I'm trying to think what the Eldrazi mechanic was. I know at one point it was the creature couldn't be bounced or exiled, which was cute, but it required like too much work around it to make sure that a bunch of the strong removal was bounce or exile. There was some version that was like can't be blocked by creatures with even power, and it was called Oddity, but that only works because the name is Oddity, and I don't know that it translates in other languages. So I think there was some version of something that they did for a long time that didn't work within the rules. It was talking about unglued mechanics, effects that end at the until end of turn don't stop. So this would be like, if I giant growth my creature, it's always giant growth, which is like, okay, that seems like that works. And it's like, but what if you do this card on it? And it's like, oh, I don't know how that works. Well, what if you do this? And it's like, ugh. So if I give it -3/-3, but what if, you know, there's too many humongous like rules questions and things that if it was adding enough to the actual fun of everything we could try to solve, but it wasn't, it was also at the same time not the most fun mechanic, so we decided, hey, we'll change things.
Co-host Nate Burgess asks, speaking of double-faced cards, does the Wizards employee who designed Docent of Perfection also run a Tal'ran Sky Summoner Commander deck?
I don't know, because I don't remember who designed the card.
If only my Tal'ran had a second Tal'ran that makes my first Tal'ran better.
Yo, dude, we heard you liked Tal'ran, so we put Tal'ran inside your Tal'ran deck.
Yeah, I don't remember how this got designed. I remember that when we were working on Shadows, we're like, okay, we'll do the second half. And then we're like, now we'll start working on this. And it was like, okay, we have to do the third half. But then we had to figure out like how it ended up. And I don't remember at what point the idea of making wizards into other little insectile aberrations came to be. But once we got that story down, that was a pretty cool thing. And then I remember just being in the top-lining meeting with the creative team where we're kind of going through all the cards in the set, and they're trying to figure out what the top line of the illustration is. And the idea of it starting off as it is its insect self with a human in the cage was just like, oh my god, this is just perfect. We have totally gotten the story to a point that we're happy with. Like the real reversal of the first image was just perfect.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That little story across three cards was beautiful. Hey, are we going to see more Meld in the future?
I don't know. Part of it will come down to whether or not people liked it. We didn't want to put more meld in the set than there was currently in it because we don't, like, if we were a digital only game, we'd have a ton of meld in the set, but we're not. There are limits to how many double face cards are basically fun per pack. And because this is Innistrad, things actually do need to transform. And we thought that if we were playing with a lot more meld, it'd be like, well, there's more meld, so it's theoretically more flavorful, but if you play limited, nothing ever transforms. So we didn't want to go too high on that. I think we found three pairs that work in, like, the black pair is really for limited. I think it works very well in limited. It took a lot of work to get there. The red and the white pairs are things that I think will work in other formats. I mean, it is not a coincidence that a land and a creature is about the smallest barrier to entry for a deck as you can get. It's not a coincidence that Bruna gets back Gisela. I mean, these things were all designed to make these work, to make them actually happen. I think if people really like it at some point, I'm not sure what the flavor will be in some other world, but we could go back to it. The big question there will be, you know, how much of it to include. Certainly, if we were doing this in a supplemental product that didn't have the same draftability aspect of a standard legal set, we could look at having more pairs or doing things like that. Like, I could imagine if we did a commander product that had a lot of double face cards, we could say, well, we'll put a bunch of meld cards in there because that's a product where that's upside. It's not like we're not like hindering anything by doing that. There, I mean, there are certain challenges that go into making meld cards above and beyond even regular double face cards, but it's something, certainly something that we can, like, once we're already kind of paying the cost of putting double face cards into a product, we can start looking at that. But in terms of when they would show up in another standard legal set, a lot of it would just come down to how much people like them and how much Mark Rosewater gets bugged about putting more of them in the sets on his Tumblr, because that does tend to have a small impact on what appears in future sets.
Yeah. He's made that clear a couple of times.
Right, I'm starting the Tumblr campaign to get a Yawgmoth card printed.
Oh, goodness. I'm not saying that this needs to happen, but if two cards were, say, to be triggered by another card, and that would result in, say, the assembly of a larger type of card, I mean, that would be kind of cool. Even if that card maybe is some sort of contraption or something. And or a Thopter Queen. Just getting that plug in. Yeah, the heat in my closet. Remember I turned the AC off. It's starting to tell on me. Hold on a second. All right, that's better.
Patron Beyonce Christension asks, regarding the card Imprisoned in the Moon, is Emrakul really being locked into the moon? If so, please tell me how that happened. Smiley face emoticon.
So I really can't talk anything about that. One of the things that we try to do with our card sets and with the official Magic story is to tie them together. And I know that I think sometime later this month, there will be a story in the official Magic fiction that actually officially wraps this up. But for now, you're just going to have to go based off of what the card says and come to your own conclusions.
He also asks, the card I'm most hyped about at the moment is Sigarda's Aid. Can you tell me more about how that card came to be and how the process went? Did it ever cost more than one mana in the development?
So if I remember correctly, I actually am unsure with that card if it was something that came through our hole filling process where we have people throughout all the hull company kind of have the ability to submit cards with some basic restrictions. Like we say, here's the set we're working on, submit some cards. It was either that or something that I just was typing in the middle of the night because I needed to get a file done. I don't remember which, but it was one of those two. And I know we were trying to play off more of the kind of equipment and artifact theme that Shadows had a little bit of for green white. And we had this idea of what if you could use all of your, originally I believe it actually tutored up an artifact or an equipment and then you could cast it with flash. But there's a card in Shadows that opened the armory that made the card two things to seem too similar. And so instead of costing like three mana, and tutoring it and letting you cast it, and maybe it was 4 mana, we ended up going down to just 3 mana, or just 1 mana, and just casting them as flash and letting you use them as combat tricks.
Hmm. So what are your 3 favorite cards from this set?
Oh boy. Definitely.
Yeah. Which are your babies?
Yeah, my babies. I definitely really like Hunterd Garrison and the Battlements That Become the Meld card. That was a card that took a lot of work and one of the ones that I designed in just the like very tactical sense of like, how do we actually get to accomplish this? Emrakul, another one of my favorite cards. It's just so over the top, but it's something that I think plays really fun. It's just, it's great to use. It feels very satisfying. And the last one, I think, is Noosesnake, which is pretty simple. It's essentially a riff on Wild Mongrel. And my friend, Matt Cranstuber, who I used to be my co-host on the In Contention podcast when I was still doing that, he bugs me every once in a while about all the cards that he wishes were in Modern that don't exist. And one of the ones that he has bugged me about previously is Wild Mongrel. And I was like, you know, I'm working on the set, and I'm like, yeah, we could just put Wild Mongrel in here, right? Like, is that too good for Standard? And everyone's like, I don't think so. I'm like, okay, well, I mean, we can't put Wild Mongrel in here because the color changing thing is bizarre, but, you know, we made a version of it with Reach, and no one managed to break it, so there you go.
Cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Listener Christopher Mosquai, it seems Eldritch Moon is going to be really good for zombies. This got me thinking. Is this level of story synergy consistent across Magic releases?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, you know, as we work on sets, we want to make things that the story sets are telling try to play out. And this set was about 2 things. One is, of course, the Eldrazi that are kind of emerging on from the denizens of Innistrad. But the other was Liliana joining the Gatewatch and her horde of zombies that she controls being an important part of that. And so, you know, as we are working on, you know, making the tribes that Innistrad has kind of work out, certainly zombies got a lot of love because, well, that's what Liliana does. She is the kind of the zombie queen. And so cards like Dark Salvation came out of the thing of like, yeah, well, we just want to make sure there's enough reasons to play zombie tribal in the upcoming Standard, and just, you know, enough exciting zombie tribal cards floating around in the set.
He also asks, do you use the storyline to perhaps indicate a deck building strategy?
That is less so. I mean, certainly we give those opportunities for these things kind of happen. You know, an earlier example is, you know, you look at Dragons of Tarkir and the dragons took over, and certainly you can play dragons. Dragons are very strong. It's not the only thing that you can do. But you're also not going to succeed if you just take all the dragon cards and dragon circuit here, put them in one deck. But certainly we like it to be that the thing the story is trying, and that we're trying to promote, that is really cool, is something that is at least competitive.
All right.
So, listener Sean Watson said,
no, he's a co-host. I know you lost your rhythm there for a few months, but you're a co-host, Sean.
Oh, you love me. You really love me. Co-host Sean Watson asks, mine's Dilation. Did you design this card for me? And if so, can I take you out for a nice steak dinner and a pint of beer?
I don't exactly remember if I designed this card. I think I did. But at some point, like when you're leading a set, things get really blurry at some point. It's like, when I first started here, I could tell you like all the cards I designed that saw print, because it's like, you know, you get like one card in a set, and all of a sudden when you're leading a set and it's like some huge number of cards that you designed or tweaked or took people's ideas and made them into things. So I think that I came up with this final version of the card based off something else that someone else had submitted. But unfortunately, I will say it is not actually just for you. So it was for the players at large. I did satisfy the people within R&D who said, dear God, can it only happen once per turn? Because this is going to be the most miserable commander card. And I said, fine. It turns out people don't like it if you have a 7-man enchantment that just says everyone in commander has to kill you with what's on the board. Not super popular. So it's okay. we'll scale it down just a notch.
Once again, I'm amazed by people's reaction when this card got spoiled. This was quite a late spoiler, I think. We had people sniffy about it. I was like, that is disgustingly brutal. Like, just gross. Turns out people like to play spells in Commander. You know, normally one a turn. At least.
Weaklings.
Right.
Yeah, and I love it. I just love it. Every time I see it, this and Shadows of Innistrad have both had 7 drop cards that people have been funny about. I've gone, are you mad? This is disgustingly powerful. The other one was Behold the Beyond, by the way.
One of the tricks I found with Commander is, I think it's important, like, this happens not just with Commander, but with all designs, where people want these cards to be super powerful and to, like, kind of win the game by themselves. And while that's kind of, like, we don't necessarily want that to happen in Standard, certainly in Commander, like, you are just dealing with a larger thing, and there are multiple people playing, and it feels fun to read a card that says, when I cast this, everyone has to deal with me because I'm kind of the king of the hill. But at the same point, people don't like it when they cast a card and everyone just kills them for it. So you do have to find that balancing point of, like, okay, you cast Mind's Dilation, and it wants to be something that's strong, but not so strong that everyone decides that you need to be wiped off the face of the earth right now. You want it to be something that they, you know, in a kind of heuristic study way of, like, yeah, you play it and you get up enough that you're getting a huge advantage of it, but it's not like you cast Heuristic Study and then immediately die, because that would not be very fun.
I think a good example of that for me is Gisela and Aurelia, the Boros commanders. Mm-hmm. If Aurelia's in your command zone, she's a powerful commander and she can win you a game, especially in that color's strategy. But no one's too worried. If Gisela's in your command zone, people just go for you because they know you're going to double damage someone off the table really fast.
Right. Kiki Jiki is an example of a commander that's like, I'm not sure what you're doing with it. You're gonna tell me. You're totally not going to do something busted with it, but is there really a reason to risk this one?
Yeah, I'll normally bribery someone and go, so you do have Zealous Conscripts in the deck, do you?
Oh.
But, oh, look at that. Everyone kill him.
Oh.
Maybe you do need to die now.
Yeah.
Mind's Dilation is going to be a little bit harder to play, because the only time you can play it is when you have 7 mana.
That's impossible to get in Commander.
Yeah, it's a very narrow window. Like, the moment you have 7 mana, you play it.
It's so good. I love it.
So, it's a really good card. I can't wait either.
Yeah, I've actually already pre-ordered like 5 copies of it.
Of course. One for each of your Dimir decks, but what about the others?
Well, there's one for my Maelstrom Wanderer deck as well.
Oh, okay. Oh, no. No, you can't put this into Maelstrom Wanderer.
Why not? It cascades into it beautifully.
No, it doesn't. It's horrible. Sean, this is a terrible card.
It's awful, isn't it? I mean, it only gets 1 free spell per player's turn normally.
Yeah, yeah.
or exiles a card off the top of their deck that you might not want them to play. You know, awful.
Yeah. Yeah, like a Maze of Ith, right? Really, really... really low downside there.
Oh, terrible.
Oh, my goodness. What a wonderful set.
I'm really looking forward to Eldritch Moon. I mean, I like Shadows of Innistrad, but Eldritch Moon feels like it's more my kind of set. And I guess that's because I'm more a blue-black kind of guy. This feels like it's indulging my demureness a lot more, the entire set is. I'm sad to hear that you took the aggressive mill strategies out of Shadows. I would have enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, they were there. We definitely are cognizant that there are a lot of people that really like that type of thing, but it is, I think, good for a color pair and bad for a set to be the whole thing the set's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm really looking forward to Sealed. right? The pre-release where we have a mix of both Shadows and Eldritch Moon, I think that's where we'll actually see the full synergies of the set, of course, but just that's where it'll all come together. And that Delirium mechanic, which was sort of hard to work with, is coming into its own.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. All right. It is almost the end of the show, and ordinarily we have some hateful card that Nate has selected, which will ruin whatever strategy we've been talking about, but we haven't been talking about a specific strategy. Instead, we might have a little bit of Planeswalker fun. Let's see where this goes. Nate?
Friend of the show, Nick Jaragrulski, says, I have some unfortunate news. While working tirelessly into the night to finish an upcoming as-yet-to-be-announced set, a portal opened up under your desk, and you were whisked away to Innistrad. Emrakul is hovering menacingly above you, and she craves a midnight snack. Same time zone. You reach into your pocket and pull out the shimmering magic card Mark Rosewater gave you during a company Christmas party 1 year. He had said it would be important one day. You use it to call for help in a time of great urgency. Which of all the planeswalkers will you call upon with this card to save you from Emrakul?
Not Liliana.
Wow. Wow. So I'm not sure he would actually save me, but I'd probably have to go with Nicol Bolas just because he's probably the biggest and the baddest.
Yes.
Like, if at least. It's like the downside is, unlike someone like Gideon, who would actually, you know, definitely would try to save me, Nicol Bolas may not save me, but at least he's going to put up a pretty good fight against Emrakul.
The thing is, right, Nicol Bolas saves you, but then you know you're his for the rest of your life, don't you?
Yeah, right. I mean, I guess I'd rather be in Nicol Bolas' debt than Emrakul's debt, so... It seems slightly better.
I believe the phrase, the verb is to tesseract oneself.
Hey, he's got a cool arm. It worked out for him.
Cyber arm, no memory. It's all been fine for Tesseract.
But if you did owe Emrakul, you would become Samrakul, wouldn't you?
I might. I thought I'd have, like, you know, two heads and, like, 7 feet or something. It's not really worth it.
Well, if you had more fingers, then you could violate the color pie more often during design.
That is just true.
It's true. Yeah. I wonder how far up he cuts, because his fingers could have fingers in that case.
Yes, got you beat there, Mark.
We should make a... I was going to say a CD, but do people actually make those anymore? And send that to Mark.
They make playlists, Phil. iPod playlists. Yeah. Get down with the kids. Deezer. These kids. Or is it Spotify? God, I'm old.
Our whack mixtapes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whack mixtapes. We're wicked cool.
Oh, yeah.
Totally,
we are proving it.
Bodacious.
Bodacious. Good lord. I don't think Sam was born when that was in use.
Well, I probably was, but yours that. I mean, certainly I remember Bodacious from my childhood, but.
That's Ninja Turtles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So that's going to be 89.
Yeah, I was born in 81. I'm fine on this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, 81, same year as me. What?
Good lord.
Do we have the same birthday? What's your birthday, Sam? We'll edit it out. You're older than me.
Aha.
Cowabunga.
Cowabunga. Eat my shorts. To the max, dudes.
Sam, we have this thing we call the Wheel of Planeswalkers. Have you been exposed to that yet?
No, I have not.
Ethan has.
Would you want to play a quick little game with us?
Sure.
That Nate always wins and I always lose.
Okay. So, by the way, while we're talking about the color pie violations, I'd love to know if Marrow's heard about this from Ethan or you.
I don't know. I'll have to find out.
Right. So, Wheel of Walkers. So, I have in front of me a digitally generated magical Wheel of Walkers. I'm going to spin the wheel. You tell me when to stop, and it will randomly generate a planeswalker. Then I'm going to give you one of the three powers And if you want an easy answer, for it's only worth 1 point, you get the ultimate. I'm going to read you the power. You just have to simply name me the Planeswalker.
All right.
And your first answer counts.
All right.
If you miss, it goes to the next highest bidder. So Phil is notoriously shite at this game. And I think he should go first.
Oh, come on. Phil, I absolutely... Yeah.
Come on down and spin the Wheel of Walkers. Tell me when to stop. The wheel's spinning.
And stop.
Okay. Okay. Do you want an easy question or a hard question?
Just give me the easy question.
Okay. You get an emblem that says, 101 black, sacrifice a creature. You gain X life and draw X cards where X is the sacrifice creature's power.
Are you kidding me? There's an emblem like that?
I'll give you a clue. It's a black planeswalker.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Oh, Lord Almighty. Is it Obnixilus, the original from the Commander set? I don't even remember his name.
I'm going to give you the point. It is Obnixilus with the Black Oath. Well done, Phil.
Thank God. Thank God. One That's point the only point Phil. I'll get.
Okay. Should we have Sam second before the Savant Nate gets going?
I swear, Nate has flashcards.
So, Sam, I'm spinning the Wheel of Walkers. Just tell me what to
stop. Right, stop.
Oh, okay. Okay. Right. So, do you want an easy question or a hard question?
I want a hard one.
Okay. Well, it's got the name of the Planeswalker in the ability, so I'll have to edit it slightly. This Planeswalker deals 2 damage to target player.
Well, it's definitely Chandra. I'm going to go with... what is it? It's the Chandra from... the flip side of Chandra from Magic Origins. Chandra the Roaring Flame, I think she's called.
It is Chandra the Roaring Flame. I was going to say, it's a set you designed, sir. So I'm pleased you got that one.
Well, the only hard part is, it's like, oh my god, there are so many Chandras that deal damage. I think she's the only one that did +2, but I couldn't remember the backside, because the trick of things that's actually harder when you're working at Wizards is names, because they change so much. So yeah. It's like, oh no, this could be out of any like 7 names that it had at some point during its design and development process.
Hey, he could accidentally spoil a Planeswalker that's not out yet by saying their name and forgetting. Oh, that's Chandra the Smoking Hot. Oh, no, it's not out yet. Anyway, 3 points to Sam. Nate, I'm spinning the wheel. Mm-hmm. Tell me when to stop, sir.
Stop it.
Okay. Do you want a hard one or an easy one?
Hard question. Always hard.
Always hard. Okay.
After dark.
Okay. Creatures you control get +1/+1 and gain trample until the end of the turn.
Mm-hmm.
This is a hard one.
The creatures you control get +1/+1, and it's a +1 ability.
That's he doesn't need ability. The clue.
That's Arlen. That's the new Arlen, who is embraced by the moon.
She is embraced by the moon. Correct, Nate. 3 points. Okay. Right, we're gonna do 2 rounds or 3 rounds, fellas.
Just 2.
Okay, Phil.
I'm already ready to kill myself here.
Phil, I'm spinning the wheel. Tell me when to stop.
All right, stop.
Okay, do you want an easy one or a hard one?
No, I'm going for the hard one because I'm betting that both Sam and Nate will get one wrong, and then I'll have 4 points and they'll have something else.
Okay. Mm. It's a -3 ability. Destroy right. target non-land permanent.
Mm.
Nate knows it.
Mm-hmm.
That's Nicol Bolas.
Incorrect. Now, so the first person to answer it gets it out of you two.
Vraska the Unseen.
It is Vraska the Unseen. Oh, points go to
damn
Nate.
It. Stupid game. What does that leave me with? -2?
One. You have 1 point, Phil. You only get 1 point for a stolen answer, Nate. So you're only on 4, I'm afraid. Sam, tell me on to stop the wheel.
Stop the wheel.
Okay. Okay. Do you want a hard one or an easy one?
I want a hard one.
Okay. Plus one. Tap target permanent. Does not untap during its controller's next untap step.
That's the original Tameo.
Tameo the?
The Moon Sage. Moon Sage?
Yay! Okay. 3 points, right. So, unless Nate messes this up, though, or unless Sam can steal it, Nate's won. He always wins. Don't you know. Right, Nate, I'm spinning the wheel. I'm spinning the wheel.
Stop it!
It's the theft. It always puts him ahead. I can't stand it. It's like I'm giving Nate a free point, basically.
Phil just feeds Nate points. Do you want an easy one or a hard one?
Hard question. Always.
Okay. Plus one. Untap up to 4 target forests.
That sounds Nissa-ish. Untap up to 4 target forests. Let's see. It's not... No, it's... Oh, she's waking. She's waking up the world. World Waker.
It is Nissa World Waker. Take it on home, Nate. You have won the adoration of Sam and the hatred of Phil. So you've not won much.
And one he already had.
Indeed. Well, there you go. That was Wheel of Walkers, folks.
Oh, God, that's embarrassing. Every single time.
Every single time. One day, someone else will run it, and I'll play it and show you just how terrible I am. It's so filthy. You might have a rival in the who's worst stake.
I think it's definitely got to be either me or Nate, depending on if you want to give somebody else a chance to win, or just mercy kill me.
Nate can run it.
Yeah, sure.
I'll let you in on a secret. I don't really have a wheel. I'm just hitting random buttons and put the word planeswalker.
Don't spoil it, because everybody heard the wheel.
I mean, I've got a constructed wheel.
The magician never reveals their secrets.
I mean, yeah, damn. I mean, it's a gold-encrusted wheel, and I've got one copy of every planeswalker in Japanese foil, sellotaped to the wheel, and I spin it around.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
It's almost a divining wheel.
Almost too good to be true. Almost.
All right, Sam, now you have experienced all that we have to offer. You've been a wonderful guest and awesome for putting up with us, especially through that miserable Wheel of Walkers. I'm somewhat jesting. That's kind of a fun segment to listen to, because that's all I get to do after all. Thank you for coming on today and making the time and all of this time.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome. And I hope to extend the invitation to you again in the future.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we didn't totally turn you off, so that's good.
Always good.
Now, how can people contact you if they want to reach out to you and say, hey, Sam, we really like you?
The best way to do it is on Twitter. My Twitter is at Sam Stodd, and I tend to respond to that somewhat frequently.
All right. And we'll also provide links in the show notes that we release to both your article archive and then the most recent article that discusses the Eldritch Moon mechanics. And again, thank you for coming on the show. It was wonderful. I was so excited. I think I mentioned this, it's 3 hours ago, but I was so nervous. I was like, finally, we get to talk to Sam. It'll be great. And so to all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in and staying tuned in through what is probably 2 wonderful episodes. I mean, I realize it's not that difficult because of the richness of the material, but it is a marathon. Thank you. And if you want to support the podcast for all the really good things we put inside of your ears, sometimes with a spoon, head on over to the Patreon page at patreon.com/commanderandmtg or give us a 5-star rating over on iTunes. We love all of you, and we're incredibly grateful to all of our patrons like Darlene, who joined us recently, and Cameron Fuller, who joined us recently. Come playtest with us as well, and if you donate $10 or more per episode, come join the patron chat we host over on Facebook. Hey, our theme song, you know that snazzy theme song you heard a long time ago, was created for the podcast by Nate Burgess.
Mm-hmm.
What was it described as on Twitter? It's a homemade banjo twang.
All right.
Yeah. Our logo was created for the podcast by Mr. Picto, who can be found at mrpicto.co.uk with assistance from Kelly. Sam, if you ever find yourself in need of a logo, personal or otherwise, we would be happy to help out with that.
All right.
Set symbols, that's almost our speciality. We've never done one.
But you could.
But we do a good one. Yeah, we could totally. Special thanks to Tech Wiz's Jesse Thompson and Graham Frank, and of course to Justin for his server space. You can reach us by going to our website, commanderandmtg.com. Our email address is cast@commanderandmtg.com. You can find us on all of the social medias by searching for Commander and MTG Podcast. We've given up naming those specifically, haven't we?
Yes.
Individually, on Twitter, I'm at KetJack.
I'm at Copain26.
I'm at Mr. Plorg.
And Sam, we have a tradition where we ask our guest to take us out. Sometimes we suggest saying, and that's our show, but you can say whatever you want.
Until next time, we're Commanderin'.
Commanderin'. Oh, awesome. Oh,
nice.
Really cool.
Yes. now the show's ended, right? I don't know if Wizards sublet people to design set symbols, but if you ever employ Phil's services, can you make sure it's for any kind of Rise of the Phyrexians pro-Phyrexia set? I would love that. That would be my Christmas and birthday present all at once.
Mm-hmm.
It would be terrible if that ended up being our first preview card, too. Like something from that, and it's some horrible praetor. Oh.
It would be glorious.
Wow, Sam, this has been wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. This has been a great time.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Phyrexian Altera. I've got oil under my skin, thin black oil squirming inside of me, my Phyrexian unlife is just the start of me. I've got oil under my skin. How I try